new pulpits are here. The new pulpits are here.
I want to welcome you all. We have a quorum?
Not yet.
Okay. But we're a quality group. We're just not a quantity group yet. Today we have a fair amount of work to do. We're privileged to have our new health commissioner here today. We also have, looks like the JRLC is here. Maybe all of you want to wave or something, and welcome to the Capitol. I know you come every year, so it's, you can come and learn about healthy things today. So that's a healthy visit to the Capitol. We have a quorum. So, now we'll come to order. And who made the quorum up? Oh, Representative. Okay, Representative McElfatrick would like to move the minutes today in honor of this special day.
This is a special day, and yes,
okay,
I
thank
move
you.
The minutes.
So,
please.
Any discussion about that besides just general enthusiasm? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. There being two ayes and no nays, but minutes are adopted. We're going to hear from the Department of Health today. And we expect that we can probably complete that presentation in a reasonable amount of time. And then we're going to take up questions and pages that were asked about in our little, from yesterday's presentation. For those of you who are just here today, if you want to listen to the Department of Human Services presentation, which was equally exciting as the one you're going to hear now, that's available on TV yesterday. We got through the whole thing in one day, so you can get the overview. Now we're going to later go into some detail on the pages of that. So, Dr. Ellinger, welcome to the committee, and you've been around now for, what, better than a month? Or no, something like that, right?
Yeah, month and 3 days.
Happy anniversary to you.
Thank you.
So I know you have a few thoughts for us, then you'll have your presenters come and go through their changes. It's all yours. Welcome. All
right, Representative Aver, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger. I'm the Commissioner of Health for the Minnesota Department of Health, and as you're well aware, budgets are the most specific focus that you can have on your priorities, for the priorities of any organization, and particularly when resources are tight, the budget really does reflect the priorities of an organization. And I'm here with the staff of the Minnesota Department of Health to go through the budget and see how it really reflects the priorities that of the Dayton administration and of the Minnesota Department of Health. After a great deal of thought and lots of work, we really see that this budget focuses on maintaining the basic services, the public health services that have helped have Minnesota make Minnesota one of the healthiest states in the nation. So this budget really does help us to maintain those basic level of services. But it also focuses on how we can do things even better, particularly at this time when we're doing health reform. It really helps us show that we have a priority of doing health reform in the right way, that focuses on our partnership with local public health, with many of whom are here today, with our partners in local public health, with the hospitals, with the clinics, that we really need to do in order to do health reform in the proper way. It focuses on our effort to really bring medicine and public health closer together, because only by doing that are we able to really get at some of the major determinants of health from both the prevention side, the health promotion side, and also the intervention side. It really helps us focus on prevention, particularly prevention of chronic illness, chronic disease, which are the leading cause of health costs rising in our society. And it helps us really focus on reducing health disparities, which are one of the areas that our state needs to have a lot of work on. So we see that the budget reflects the priorities that have been part of the department and will continue to be part of the department. It supports that. And we see that this budget is a good investment, both for maintaining our current health, but moving us on a path where health improves dramatically over the next several years. So with those brief remarks, I'm going to invite Craig Akam, who's the Assistant Commissioner of Health, and Barb Julik, our Chief Financial Officer, to go through the budget pages with you.
And Dr. Ellinger, whereas yesterday I let the other commissioners bail out of here, this is your one shot at us on this topic. So if anybody wanted to ask the commissioner a question, we actually have time for that today. So I didn't warn you about that, but I figured you can think on your feet. Seeing a large line of people wishing to ask you questions, I guess you get to escape anyway. So thanks for coming.
Thanks.
And members, in your books, our staff sat up here till 8 o'clock last night. 9 o'clock last night, listening to Bob Marley, putting this book together. Some of you are, and they're by sections. Some of you have tabs. Some of you are tab disadvantaged, and we're sorry about that. But there are at least those who don't have tabs. They're separated by colored paper. And the so the summaries are in the front and the changes are later?
The changes are behind the front.
Okay, so there's the first chunk is about the department, and it's really good reading, and especially if you're new to the topics, it's a really good one-stop thing. I think that we've given you last year's versions of these comment pages anyway. And then as you read through, you'll notice the last chunk is the various changes, which you went through yesterday on the human service one. And so now we'll hear about the health people. Welcome to the committee. Who's going to go first?
I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Members, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Acom.
Well, one thing else, there's some of the health change pages are missing. So we're, if you don't have the change pages that he's going to announce, we'll find them. So that's the little snag. So sorry about the snag.
Well, you can start over if you want. Mr. Chair.
So, yeah. Start
with,
over.
With me is also Barb Julek, our Chief Financial Officer. I think the Department of Human Services set the bar yesterday for walking through their change pages, and we'll attempt to follow that example. I'll start off first. We have three investments that the governor is proposing in our budget. These are continuing investments stemming from 2008 legislation, largely around health reform and prevention, that was seen then at the time in a bipartisan fashion to help us get a handle on rising health care costs and look toward the future, not just the immediate present, in terms of the 10% a year rise in health care costs that is going to continue to be a larger and larger part of our budget. The first one is on page 11, and please interrupt me, Mr. Chair, if I'm hitting pages that the members don't have, but the first one is an investment in the governor is proposing to continue funding for the statewide health improvement program at $20 million a year, which is reduced from the current funding level of $27 million. For those of you who aren't familiar with SHIP, SHIP is an integral component of state health reform passed in the 2008 legislative session aimed at improving the health of Minnesotans and containing the spiraling costs of health care. It accomplishes this by addressing the leading preventable causes of illness and death in the U.S., which are tobacco and obesity. SHIP takes a comprehensive approach to improving the policy systems and environments across communities, schools, businesses, and healthcare settings through the use of evidence-based strategies that reduce the incidence of chronic disease. SHIP moves upstream to make a lasting, widespread impact on the health of Minnesota's populations, which will lower the overall cost of medical care over time. SHIP works across the state with community health boards and tribal governments, engaging local community decision-making and over 1,000 partners to date. Many of these organizations and governmental partners are here with us today in the gallery. It is also Local Public Health Association Day here at the Capitol, and so I'd like to welcome our local public health partners who are here for the hearing. And these folks and our other partners have leveraged this state investment with their local public and private resources and efforts. Another important component of SHIP is funding for evaluation and technical assistance to ensure the strategies are effectively implemented and that the program goals are being met. Minnesota is nation-leading in this approach to primary prevention of chronic diseases, with CDC and other states looking to our example. If funding for this initiative were to end, the state would lose momentum gained over the last 18 months of the operation of this program and continue to see rising health care costs due to these preventable diseases. And Mr. Chair, while I'm taking more than a minute per page for the investments, Ms. Julek, I'm sure, will make up for the lost time when she talks about our reductions. So.
Well, Mr. Acom, I just had a visit from my school lunch ladies. I guess they don't mind being called that. They have breakfast, too. But there's a piece of that in Anoka High School. They talked about something with vegetables and promoting that. And so my son is eating more vegetables because of SHIP, I think. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, that is excellent to hear. So. Our next investment is on page 13 of your packets around health care reform. The governor is proposing to continue funding of $2.5 million per year beginning in 2013 for statutorily required health care reform activities also stemming from the 2008 legislative session. The 2008 legislature provided funding through fiscal year 12 for the department to collect quality of care data from physicians, clinics, and hospitals and cost of care data from health plans. These data are used as part of the provider peer grouping and quality data efforts defined in statute. Information collected and analyzed provides consumers with critical information about the cost, quality, and overall value of healthcare services. Public and private payers are required to use this information to establish incentives for consumers to use higher quality, lower cost providers. Since the passage of the 2008 reforms, MDH has adopted and implemented administrative rules related to the collection of quality of care measures and cost data. This is also nation-leading, and these efforts will continue to yield valuable information for consumers and healthcare purchasers and payers in the future, provided analysis are updated and reported on at least an annual basis. MDH has an ongoing obligation to conduct these activities, but without the funding in this request, will not be able to continue the work after fiscal year 12. To offset this cost in the coming biennium, you'll also notice on the page the department is proposing to transfer $2.8 million in funds from the Electronic Health Record System Revolving Account and Loan Program. These funds were appropriated in 2010 to provide matching funds for a federal e-health loan program that have not been made available and are not anticipated to be made available. And Mr. Chair, members, our last investment is on page 15 of your packets, fetal alcohol syndrome spectrum disorders. The governor proposes a $340,000 annual increase for FASD grants. Currently, the department awards $1.66 million in grants. This request will increase the amount to $2 million a year to expand current efforts to prevent fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and support individuals with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and their families. FASD is 100% preventable, but affects one of every 100 live births per year. Fetal alcohol syndrome represents the severe end of these disorders and has an estimated national cost of $1.6 billion. Although there is no cure for fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, research shows that early intervention and treatment can improve a child's development and impact long-term outcomes. This proposal increases the department's efforts to provide diagnostic services, interventions, and family support, public awareness, and professional education programs through the current program.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken. So those were all had a base funding of zero, and these numbers increased the, like the ship was not, so the ship's in the base, fetal alcohol is increased in the base?
That's correct.
And then that other compliance thing?
The health reform activities.
Those are now in the base.
Yes.
That's the proposal. Any questions? Let's just separate these into two topics. So actually, that makes you the good cop, right?
Yeah.
It's good to be you today. Any questions about these three topics? I guess you were thorough and persuasive, so thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Ms. Julick, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, Barb Julick, Department of Health Chief Financial Officer. I'll be going through the rest of the pages, starting on page 17. This is the first of the reduction pages. This page deals with the governor's recommendation to eliminate the MRC direct grants. These are different than the formula grants that were in the Department of Human Services budget yesterday. These grants total $5.35 million and are allocated to three entities and statutes. These entities include the University of Minnesota Fairview, University of Minnesota Academic Health Center, and University of Minnesota Dental School. About $737,000 of these grants are paid for with federal funds, so the net state savings through this elimination is $4,613,000. These savings would begin in fiscal year 13 under this proposal.
Mr. Chair.
Ripson, help me.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Ms. Julick. These cuts, the effect on the institutions will be double because of the loss of federal money?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Julick.
Representative Hundley, the effect will be $5,350,000, of which $737,000 was federal and $4,613,000 is state.
And this is on top of the $12,808,000 that the Human Services is cutting MRC. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And Mr. Chair,
help me.
They just, where are we going to get our docs in the future, particularly the primary care docs, if we start closing down some of our residency programs? And I can tell you that a number of them are right on the financial edge of going under as we sit here today. And so we're talking some very serious cuts to residency programs.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer. Anybody else got a question about them? Or continue on.
Okay, Mr. Chair, moving to page 18, this budget-saving page is also dealing with MERC. This proposal transfers the fund balance in the MERC fund to the general fund. Current fund balance of about $9.8 million is comprised of two components. The first is a continual roll forward of $8.4 million, and the second is an accumulated balance in the dental innovation grants from underspending in prior fiscal years.
Questions? Okay, I guess keep going.
All right, Mr. Chair, the third reduction page on page 19 is dealing with federally qualified health centers. This proposal eliminates the one-time increase in federally qualified health center grants out of the Health Care Access Fund while maintaining base funds of $2.5 million per year for this program.
Questions?
Catching up on time.
Yeah, I guess you're catching up with DHS on how quick you're going here. So,
all right, Mr. Chair, the last budget reduction page is on page 20. This deals with the operating reductions for the Department of Health. This page reflects reductions in all three appropriation funds. First, on the general fund, this reduces general fund operating by $1.3 million per year. This represents a 5.5% reduction in the department's operating budget. Healthcare Access Fund. Reductions include the elimination of data collection activities around the physician clinic financial and statistical data, prescription drug spending and rebate data, and retrospective review of capital expenditures, along with some additional reductions in that fund. And finally, TANF reductions, about 20,000 per year, is based on combining two separate training and evaluation efforts for the department's TANF program into one effort, saving $20,000 a year. If you recall, yesterday the department had a TANF refinancing page that included refinancing TANF savings into general fund savings. This $20,000 was part of that page.
Thank you. And Ms. Dulick, the reports, with this three report, the three things we're not going to collect data on, is anybody going to miss that information?
Mr. Chair, with the prescription drug spending report, this we were required to put together for public use, and we have yet to have a request for that information. The retrospective review of capital expenditures, the view of the department was not sure what the benefit was for looking backwards at these expenditures. And on the physician clinical financial and statistical data, the department hasn't found a lot of use for this information.
Thank you. And actually, you've got a friendly face on this this kind of topic, at least on those kinds of reports. And it's the view of this chair and many members of this committee that there's a bunch of reports that get collected by some people who work in your department and others that really don't serve any particular purpose except they create a burden on the people who do it. And so are you going to be bringing forward a list of more reports that maybe you don't need to waste time collecting and us doing, or do you want us to provide you with our own list later on?
Mr. Chair, I think this
Mr.
is Mr. So, and so, but we'd be happy to talk with the committee about other concerns that they may have about activities that we're doing.
I appreciate that. And just who's ever listening to this thing, we're looking for those kind of reports and lists of things. And not to be facetious, and we understand the challenges we're under, and some of the choices you made we're not that excited about. And so the more we can get rid of some of these things that are superfluous, the more we can just avoid those kinds of choices. So, thanks.
Mr. Chair, the next three pages deal with our state government special revenue fee programs. The first page, 21, is a request to modify fees in the well program. This includes fees for newly constructed wells, well sealing, and well disclosure fees at the time of property transfer. It also creates a renewal fee for licensed and well boring contractors. These fees would be deposited in the State Government Special Revenue Fund, and we would request an appropriation of a like amount that would allow us, the department, to continue to meet its current requirements under this program.
Any questions? Ms. Dulick, this recovers the cost. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next fee change is on page 23. This also has to do with the well program. This proposal would change the current definition of heat exchangers from vertical heat exchangers to bored geothermal heat exchangers. This will allow inclusion of angled boring machines that are used to install heat loop exchangers. This change will ensure that all heat loop exchange systems are installed by licensed and bonded individuals.
I don't see the lobbyists for the board geothermal heat exchangers coming down to testify about this, so I guess you can keep going. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chair, the last state government special revenue fee change is actual creation of a new program for the enclosed sports arena certification area. This would allow expansion and modernization of the current indoor sports arena certification program to include assessing current health risks, modernizing air monitoring standards, complaint follow-up, and research and education on best practices for indoor air quality issues. This proposal creates an annual certification fees for indoor sports arena and special event fees. Again, the fees would be deposited into the state government special revenue fund, and we would request an appropriation to cover the cost of the programs based on those fees. Linked to this proposal is a general fund savings on the operating page of that $1.3 million, $40,000. Is shifting our current program out of the general fund into this fee program. So currently we have about a half an FTE dedicated to this. This would move it to a fee program.
Ms. Julik, I remember a couple of years we talked about indoor air quality at these arenas, and did we pass something about that?
Mr. Chair, there were proposals last year, but nothing passed.
Oh, it was last year. Okay. Is this going to be controversial?
Mr. Chair, I think there's a great number of people that are interested in indoor sports arena being certified as their air being safe. So I don't think that it's controversial, but you know, I think that people have varying opinions on the matter.
Yes, it's controversial. Oh, any questions? And so the Department of Health would, of course, assert this is critically important. So I take that at what it is. And I like clean air, too. Any questions about this? Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, the last five proposals deal with the Clean Water Legacy Act funding. The first two, starting on page 27, deal with continuing current activities that were appropriated 2 years ago with this funding. The drinking water contaminants of emerging concern on page 27, this proposal continues the funding for drinking water contaminants and expands the department's capacity for developing and implementing water analysis for emerging contaminants, analyzing risks from exposures to contaminants of concern, and communicating the results of these activities to the public and other public health and environmental protection programs.
Any questions about that? All right, keep going.
And maybe, Mr. Chair, I should point out that appropriations 2 years ago were one time with the idea of coming back with these programs for renewal. So this is an example of coming back. The next page, 28, Mr. Chair, is another request out of the Legacy Act funding for source water protection. This, along with the prior page, again, is continuing current activities that began 2 years ago to accelerate the development and implementation of wellhead or surface water intake protection plans, improve data sharing with external partners so that all plans can be completed within 10 years compared with 25 years of the current pace, and expand the level of technical assistance provided to public water suppliers relating to the source water protection programs.
And this was, we were just talking about the source of the money. So there'll be a proposal going to the Legacy Committee, and then that would be appropriated to you if should you get it. And does that ever come to us to appropriate it to you? It goes...
Mr. Chair, I believe that would depend on your structure and how the House is deciding to handle these issues.
You'll let us know. Okay. Good luck at the Legacy Committee. You
or
can tell us
Chair,
the rest of
perhaps
stuff.
You'll let us know. Yeah. I think that with the new committee structure, you know, that some there isn't historical precedent for some of this. So.
And so I wonder if they'll ask us if we have recommendations or not. Anyway, members, if you have interest in these matters, I suggest you at least lobby the Legacy Chair and your various leaderships to put this on their list. So. Anyway, so keep going. It's good to hear what you're up to.
Mr. Chair, the third proposal is on page 31. This is a county well index and well water risk evaluation proposal. This proposal provides funding for the enhancement of the current county well index database to begin converting it from a well site database to an informational resource for the public on drinking water in their community. The second part of this proposal would provide funding for the department to develop a methodology for designating public health risk related to human and natural impacts on the drinking water.
Keep going.
All right. On page 34. This is a well ceiling cost share proposal, which would provide fundings for grants to assist with well ceiling costs for private and public wells. There are approximately 500,000 unused wells that remain unsealed in the state of Minnesota. Unsealed wells can pose a threat to groundwater by allowing contaminants to bypass natural geological protections. This proposal would provide for a 50-50 cost share program for grants for sealing public and private wells. Criteria would be established to rank funding requests based on public health and environmental risk.
Questions? You're doing great.
All right, last page, Mr. Chair, page 35, dealing with GPS location of wells and arsenic testing. The first part of this proposal would create standards for using global positioning systems to locate all wells constructed and sealed in Minnesota. Currently, licensed well contractors are required to submit locations of wells and borings they construct and seal. Satellite-based GPS provides the most accurate information. This proposal would provide funding for GPS equipment, maintenance, and training for well contractors. The second part of this proposal would focus on arsenic testing for new wells. Drilling new wells can alter the geochemistry around the well, making it possible for arsenic levels of newly constructed wells to change over time. This proposal would sample 120 newly constructed wells that have been constructed since August 2008 and compare arsenic results with samples collected when the wells were first drilled. If a significant change occurs, supplemental testing will be performed to help characterize the cause of this change.
Well, thank you. It seems like these are the sort of things that people had in mind when they were hoping the money came and the election of it. Representative Slawick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the department. I think Representative Lowen and I are probably interested in drinking water issues. They've been a big issue out in our area. So at some time, it was about two proposals ago about the I assume those are the PFCs and the emerging all the emerging chemicals and so forth. So at some point, we'd want to talk about that and how it's funded and what's happening with that. So, Mr. Chair, it's not the time now, but be interested where they're going with it.
Well, this is the end of your change pages?
Mr. Chair, if I could just provide an overall summary.
Oh, you do a summary, then actually you can ask a real question if you want. This is our, they're here today, they're going to go to wherever they go when they leave here and not come back for a while until they're resummoned. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we have a little time, so this is a good day for it.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the governor's proposal creates about $21.3 million of savings for the Department of Health, of which about $17 million is associated with general fund savings. This represents about 11% of the department's general fund budget. It does also request about $50 million in investments, including the SHIP and the health care reform and the Clean Water Act. Of that $50 million, about $46 million is just continuing current activities. With the remaining four being expansion or new activities.
Representative Slawick,
go ahead. Mr. Chair, so my question would be on page 27. I see Mr. Stein is here as well. I think two questions for the emerging contaminants. That's the PFCs and the, I'm not sure I'm going to get all the initials right, the PFBAs. And isn't there a report coming out on this?
Mr. Chair, my name is John Stein. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection, and Representative Slawick, the reports that we do on contaminants of emerging concern are actually establishing health risk limits or health risk advisories. The contaminants you're talking about, perfluorinated compounds, there have been, we've already published those numbers, and we are doing some ongoing biomonitoring work in the community to see how the interventions have help to lower the levels of PFCs in the population there. So you might be thinking of that report. Okay. This work is tied directly to developing the health risk information associated with contaminants that are not subject to what's called a maximum contaminant level under the EPA's Safe Drinking Water Act. So they're contaminants that we find present in the state of Minnesota to which our population is exposed. And then we look at the available toxicological information and come up with health risk information associated with those contaminants that will be not really on the federal radar for quite some time because they're either not present in other states or people are not exposed to them in other states. So this work is really to characterize those contaminants that are relevant to our population for which the federal government will not be making determinations.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Stein. Just to clarify, we've talked about this a lot, and we've talked a lot about it in Oakdale and in Woodbury and in our communities. So with because the health risks have been established, is that an all? Remember, there's PFCs and there's like 8 different ones. Are all of those clear, or will any of those be part of that? Have all those been set? The health risk limits for the potential contamination from 3M dumping into the landfills.
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, we do have values established for 3 of the PFCs, PFBA, PFOA, and PFBS. Those are all perfluoro, and then you got to add a whole bunch of long syllable words after that. But they're 3 compounds that are a byproduct of 3M's manufacturing process that were disposed of in landfills and other disposal sites across Washington County during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. And there are other PFCs that are found in the groundwater for which there are either no health studies yet available or for which we don't believe people are being exposed at a high enough level. One of the things that did occur following the discovery of those compounds in the groundwater were there are a number of interventions carried out in the community. The city of Oakdale, as you know, has granular activated carbon treatment of their wells to lower the concentrations of PFCs in their drinking water. The city of Lake Elmo constructed a new water supply system to serve households that had previously been on private wells. And those residents are drinking water that is below the health risk levels. The same thing that was carried out similarly in Cottage Grove, Newport, Woodbury. Woodbury did not have any areas of high concern except around the Woodbury disposal site, an old 3M dumping site. So the good news from a health risk standpoint is the population was served with water that was treated or not did not contain those contaminants. So the other study we're working on right now that I know was to look at the sample populations, 2 sample populations of people who volunteered for studies to look at levels in their blood of these compounds. We collected that data 2 years ago, and we're now in the process of collecting it again to see if their levels are declining, and that's the intention of that report, is to look at that information.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to the indoor ice arena page. Though I'm not a hockey player, I got someone involved with this issue last year, the member of the Amateur Sports Commission. And could you just go over a little more detail, whoever wants to answer it, about what the practice was prior to this change page, and a little bit about the rulemaking and the process to make sure that the indoor ice arenas are healthy to be in while folks...
Page 25, maybe. Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden. Previously, the department had, as Ms. Julek pointed out, $40,000 in general funds to conduct a certification program. We're one of 3 states in the nation that has any regulation at all for indoor air in enclosed sports arenas. Those regulations were first enacted, as it says on your change page, in 1977, and they were intended to achieve a certain level of air quality by assuring that air handling systems met exchange rates, and we would investigate on complaint, and we would do special licensing or certification efforts around special events when they'd have monster truck shows at the Metrodome, for example. There'd be a test run to see if the air quality levels prior to the people being there to attend the event would meet expectations for safe air standards. So that was a $40,000, half an FTE. We really worked on almost a complaint basis to evaluate concerns that were brought forward, what the rulemaking activity we're currently engaged in, and what this proposal will do is update our standards for carbon monoxide and nitrous oxide, and we will be looking at new and improved ways of monitoring air quality in enclosed sports arenas so that there's a more rapid evaluation process should there be a concern, and it will establish a sort of a level playing field of expectations for air monitoring and air handling systems based on current best practices. One of the things that you if you were in the legislative process last year, you'll know that there are folks passionately interested in this because there are children and adults who spend a lot of time in enclosed sports arenas for hockey and for figure skating and for other activities, and enclosed go-kart tracks are becoming more popular in some parts of the state as well. So all of that leads us to conclude that it's time to take this approach of adopting current standards and then having a fee program in place to assure that we can respond quickly.
Hayden.
So, Mr. Chair, so the appropriation, the 200, is that 250,000?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then, but we also have some fees. So, what's the interplay between the appropriation and the fees that you're anticipating getting back from the arenas?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, it's a wash.
It's a wash. Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, just the last follow-up. After you develop the rulemaking to say kind of what you, I take that that's what you say, what is safe and not. And
correct.
And then you have a monitoring system. Are you going to also come out with recommendations on how, what arenas need to do in order to keep their arenas safe? Because that was part of, if I remember, Representative Hansen's bill was explicitly asking for not only the monitoring, but then, did it say this is what you need to? I mean, it didn't prescribe what the HVAC system or the air exchange system needed to be. It just simply said, here's what you need to do, and if it's not, then you're in violation. Can you help me?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, we currently provide technical assistance out of our general fund, that half an FTE. We give advice to arena owners and evaluate their systems right now. What this will do is expand our capacity to provide that kind of support and assistance. There was last year considerable discussion about what standard of monitoring would be required. The rulemaking will address that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so this would be, Mr. Stein, this is a new $900 fee then for these arenas that didn't have a fee before.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Do they have an idea that this is in the, this is a new proposal? Oh, okay, so well,
that's correct.
We'll wait for the phone to ring. Thank you.
Mr.
Any
Chair,
other?
Yeah.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Just a matter of interest, we certainly all want to have good indoor air and for all these folks, no doubt about it. Just a quick question, because I think I heard on the news about an incident, but I believe it was in another state. So I just want to check. You know, you've dealt with complaints or other issues. What has been the level of complaints or problems or anything else that, to this date, you've received on this issue?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Kiffmeyer, I don't have the number of complaints by year. I can certainly go back to our staff and get that information. The one that you probably saw in the news report occurred in Denver, in the Denver area, and there have been reports and admissions reported to ERs as a result of concerns over indoor air and respiratory conditions of people in Minnesota. But we'll go back and gather that information, report it back to the committee.
Another question.
Upson Kiffmeyer.
I notice here that you're just applying, it appears to be, that the fee on all arenas. I mean, there are arenas that already have, you know, electronic means and do not use internal combustion. So, but your proposal here would be no matter what kind of system they have or what they have already?
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's correct. There are, as you say, electronic ice surfacing systems, other methods that will greatly reduce the risk of carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide, but there are other systems at work in the buildings that could pose risk. That's our intention, is to apply the fee uniformly.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, I think those are good questions. You know, it's obviously you're concerned about whether everybody should be charged the same for this. But I just want to sort of, for those who haven't heard this issue before, the way we're discussing it, it sounds kind of, you know, we're talking about it in terms of the money and the fee and all this. But I remember some of the testimony when we heard this bill. I think it was Representative Rick Hansen's bill. And we had a skater in here who'd been a skater for a long time. and had some really significant health problems that she never realized all the years she was skating. She was breathing toxins, and, you know, we would never let our kids sit in the garage and run the car and sit there and breathe it. And in some of these facilities, that's almost what's happening, because you've got the Zambonis, you've got internal combustion engines running inside closed spaces, and people are breathing that stuff. And so that's why, you know, initially you look at this and you go, oh, indoor air, you know, how important can that be? Well, this, in some cases, this is really major, major serious issues. So I just wanted to say that, let us keep that in mind when we hear about this. And I don't know, I'm not expressing an opinion about whether this is the right way to go at it, Representative Kiffmeyer, but I just wanted to make sure everybody understood what we're talking about here.
And Mr. Stein, currently I represent one of these arenas, and I'm sure most of us have one or more just because they're so everywhere. Do they know now that they're expected to maintain a certain level of air quality, and do they have some means that we provide to them to help them test just on their own if they were interested in
Mr. Chair,
doing the right thing?
Yes, we provide that information to them. Currently, under the existing rules, they're aware of what they're required to be get certificates for special events and what the standards are. So we've worked with all those arena owners around the state to inform and educate them. There's quite a bit of information on our website, and prior to the website being in place, I know we had annual mailings and information that was provided to arena operators at before we had a website.
And the standards aren't suggested to be changed, just the way that you help people get to have those be maintained consistently?
Mr. Chair, there's been a considerable discussion in the work group on the rules related to the levels that should be established. I don't have the answer for you right now about whether we're going to propose what a change in that level. That's currently being discussed in the rulemaking process.
And Mr. Stein, we don't have the language of your proposal in front of us, but is part of it going to include that you would do rulemaking about levels?
Mr. Chair, the department already has authority to adopt these rules. It's currently in the statute, so we could provide you with a copy, most current information about the rulemaking and where we're thinking that's going.
New rules sometimes generate enthusiasm on the part of many members and public members. So, any other questions about this or any other health department? Representative, you don't? Okay, I thought you did. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, this is for Ms. Julek. On the this particular in your department's cut to Merck, will that also cause them to lose federal match, or is there no federal match with this money?
Ms. Gulick.
Mr. Chair, this proposal would lose $737,000 of federal match.
Okay. Oh, and Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a momentary break in the action. And, Mr. Chair, you announced that the folks from the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition were here. And the Emerging Organizers Group, which many of are from the 64A, the district I represent, have left. But they have for us some information, which is titled Prayers and Meditations for People Who Serve in the Public Arena, that they asked me to distribute to the committee. So if one of the pages could help me, I've got a little information from that group for us, which, you know, is really nice given what we're facing this year.
I think we could use a lot of prayers.
Thank you.
Okay, well, any other health department questions? I think you've done very well, and we've had lots of questions, and I know you'll be around for later when other proposals come forward, so thanks.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
And we're going to change gears now to the Department of Human Services. They have a list of, looks like about maybe half of the areas drew interest about looking into them further. Mr. Kerber, I think, is coming down if he's around. And so the department has a list, and so they know what they're going to be bringing up. And so if they would just kind of go through their own little system and then tell us what page you're on, and then we'll follow that through. Welcome, Mr. Kerber. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division. And I was asked to come back and talk about a little bit more about pages, the change pages 16 and 19. And to help this discussion, I distributed some information about how our licensing fees will be changed in the proposal. There are the first of these two budget change pages addresses licensing fees that we charge to DHS license programs, and the second one is related to background study fees. And just stepping back and reminding the committee what's up, what we're up to here, there's two things really going on. There is no increase in funding proposed for the licensing division or any of these licensing activities. There's simply a refinancing of what we currently do. And the refinancing is seeking to do two things. One is to make us more of an enterprise activity, where I think, as Deputy Commissioner and Barry said the other day, to charge the fees to those who are most directly receiving the benefits of our licensing. So what we're trying to do is to be more like the other regulatory agencies, like our sister agency, the Health Department, who was up here and talked about their funding with the state, their relationship with the state government special revenue fund. So what we have been doing over time is we have been, our licensing activities have been dependent on the general fund and appropriations from the general fund. We've had fees that we have collected, but the fees have not actually recovered the costs of doing these activities. So the appropriation we got from the general fund was more than our contribution back to the general fund with the fees that we collect. What's being done here in this first proposal is to move that whole relationship from being with the general fund to the state government special revenue fund. And so in doing that, we have to also collect a bit more money to fully fund that state government special revenue fund, and then ask you for an appropriation back from that fund rather than the general fund. The difference is $900,000. So these licensing activities that are addressed on page 16 cost $3 million. Today we're collecting $2.1 million. We need to collect another $9 million. The funding, the savings to the general fund, it gets complicated by the fact that the difference between what were appropriated and what we reimburse back to the general fund, that difference draws a federal match of 35%. And so while we're moving our $3 million out of the general fund and we're collecting another $900,000, we're really only saving the general fund $585,000.
So you're helping balance Washington's debt. I think they all appreciate that. So,
Mr. Chair, a little bit.
It all helps. Yeah.
And so the handouts, and I hopefully you have the handouts. Representative Slavik had asked for some information. I tried to provide a little detail on some handouts that you have. There should be two of them. One is a multi-page staple document, and one is a two-sided document. I'll just mention the single piece of paper that has charts on both sides. On one side it says DHS budget proposal typical licensing fee change or license fee change. And this what this shows sort of at a glance is that for the most typical programs, fees that we have now, starting with adult daycare at the top, that a typical adult daycare program currently pays $400 a year for a licensing fee. The new fee would be $500 a year. And as you go down here, you can see the different types of services. Child care centers under this proposal currently are paying $225 a year, and they're actually going to have a decrease in their licensing fee down to $200. And they're the only type of provider that actually is getting a decrease here, and I'll explain why that is. You might recall that a couple years ago we had a similar proposal to move our funding relationship from the general fund to the state government special revenue fund. And there were two things that were different. One is we were not quite as surgical in our assignment of licensing fees. And the other was we were seeking at that time to include the cost of doing background studies within the licensing fee. The second proposal we have here is to remove that background study fee from the general fund appropriation entirely and collect a separate fee for that. So I'll talk about that in a minute. And so this is intended to simply cover the cost of our regulating these types of providers, and doing site visits and inspections, issuing licensing sanctions, doing complaint investigations, doing maltreatment investigations, and all of the other regulatory activities that we do for those providers. Now, there's one other variable that's in play here, and that's that for some types of services that we regulate, our activities are subsidized by federal funding. And so we get some federal funding to help us do licensing activities for chemical dependency treatment programs, and we get some for child care programs, and a significant amount for child care programs. And then there's a little bit more for children's residential facilities. And so where we have that that supplemental federal funding, we're applying that against what our costs, what we actually should be recovering from the providers. And so that's one of the differences from several years ago, is we divided those appropriations more broadly across our licensing activities, and this time we didn't. And so that's why for child care centers, where we do get a significant amount of public funding to help our activities, their annual licensing fee is going to drop slightly, but we're going to pick up some additional fees on the background study side. So the handout that I gave kind of breaks it down for the different types of services that we license, and shows that for the capacities what their licensing fee was and what it's going to be.
Questions? Representative Slava.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Kerber, yes, I had called. You know, I called you yesterday after the hearing, and we talked about this. I think so. It's different than the last time's proposal, because we had a big reaction to the last proposal, so that's a good thing. And it was the centers, right, that it was a significant increase, so that's not happening, from what I hear you saying. The background studies, I did notice that was broken out, but that seems to be pretty low, under $100 maybe, or you can clarify a little bit about that. And then are there any, because I can't analyze it all and track it all, are there any significant increases for any particular industry, or is it and kind of flat overall, or just small?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slavik, there are some, there's quite a range here, actually, and so while we're trying to be more surgical in our application of our actual of our costs, there are some. One of the other, kind of a third difference last time, is that we were not extending these licensing fees to some of the programs that are currently exempt from a licensing fee. Some of the programs that are currently exempt include those programs operated by the Commissioner of Human Services. So the Commissioner of Human Services is a payer, a provider, and a regulator. And it had been the will of the legislature in past years that we would not collect a fee from the department's own programs. We're proposing in this that we do collect a fee. And so the most significant fee increase here would be for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and their licensing fee would be $20,000 a year. What that reflects is our actual effort at regulating those services. It includes, you know, our site visits, complaint investigations, alleged maltreatment investigations, again, and the amount of time we spend on those. So there is kind of a full range. Other programs, I think, you know, if you look at, there's a $600 a year increase for children's residential facilities. That might be kind of tough. There are some that are tougher than others in here.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up, and then I can talk with you more about it at another time, but, or maybe it's a question for you, Mr. Chair. If there are differences and people are concerned about that, should they write a letter to the committee, or what do you suggest? Talk to Mr. Kerber? You know, I'm just trying to think process here in terms of if they need to be perhaps changed, giving feedback on that.
Well, Representative Slavik, at this point, it's the governor's proposal.
Right.
And we would then, as this committee, elect to adopt that or not.
Okay.
And so at this point, they'd probably, I think you write Mr. Kerber a letter. Yeah, that's it. If we give you your phone number and your address, too, so they can just get a hold of you. And I think that he's actually, you're on TV, so now people know who you are, so they'll see you by the water cooler. But so I think at this point it's appropriate to deal with the department, and then they would tell you and say, it's great, we endorse this, or please don't do it to us, or something like that. And Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, all of these changes will be detailed in language. So right now our fees are set in our Human Services Licensing Act, and so to implement this will be, you know, many lines of new language, and so all of that will be subject to review and amendment.
Well, Mr. Kerber, so is this going to be in your department licensing bill?
Mr. Chair, a department licensing bill would be a policy bill.
Oh, good.
At this point.
This would be in the Huntley bill, then, yeah. Perhaps. So they would then, when they get a hold of... I'm just bugging you. But, so we talked about who would carry the governor's bill, so whoever that person is will take the phone calls, too. But I think we're in this together, and we're having a little fun with one of our very good state employees here. But and so the basic bottom line of this is you're saving $585,000, moving this to an enterprise activity, best that you can think of, and if we like that idea, we should do it. If not, then we'll have to decide about that.
Mr. Chair, that's accurate.
Any yep. questions about that?
Yes,
thanks.
I do.
Okay.
Oh, Representative Kiffmeyer
okay.
has a question.
I think it. I have some of the questions and so on, but I couldn't help but notice I was kind of looking for anything that was maybe a that didn't have a current fee and that was a new fee. And I actually came across one, which was surprising. It's the psychopathic personality. Mm-hmm. There's two of them. Yes. I thought that was a very interesting that they would have a fee of $20,000 apiece. And there's only two of them. So I thought since this was brand new, that it might be helpful to just kind of know what this was.
Yes, wow. Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, that that's kind of the old terminology name for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program that I mentioned. And so because many of the commissioners, it's not a new program, it's a new fee for an existing program. So there's two of those, one in Moose Lake, one in St. Peter. They had been exempt from the fee.
Okay.
So
Mr. Kerber, so on the in that other page, mm-hmm. then there's an add back mm-hmm. for this expense. Is that... Does that make the balance out then? Is that right?
Yes. Mr. Chair, the second change page then is our background study proposal.
Oh, and well, keep going. You're doing
good. And that's, I think, probably best summarized on the back side of that that one-page sheet with the charts on. And that shows, you know, what we're proposing here is that we start charging a background study fee for every background study initiated by a program that's licensed by our agency. We already charge a $20 fee for PCA studies, for adult foster care studies, for supplemental nursing service agency studies. Wherever there have been new background studies moved under our responsibility, the legislature has assigned the fee so that it pays for itself. These have been continued to be funded under the general fund, and so what we're proposing here is to separate that out from, in theory, being collected as part of the licensing fee and just do it separately. So as you can see on the attached page, a child care center would be, what we'd be doing is collecting another $400,000 a year across the board for child care center background studies. And so while their licensing fees are going to go down, the estimated average for background study fee cost to a child care center would be $266 here we have. So,
which is new.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you're saying that, is that a new cost to them? This is a new... So in addition to the fees going up, they also will have this additional cost when they do background studies. So this is on top of that fee increase,
Mr.
correct?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, that's correct.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber, what's not clear to me is in the past there have been proposals to take the background studies at the state level, because mm-hmm. right now most background studies are done at the county level, and then those are charged to the county, is my understanding, because we've had debates about this and bills introduced mm-hmm. on this. So the state's going to charge a fee for the ones done at the county level, or can you clarify how is that going to work?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, actually, for all DHS licensed programs except family child care, the department does the background studies. We also do the background studies for our Department of Health license program, so for nursing homes, hospitals, home health agencies. We do them for the Department of Corrections. We do them on unlicensed PCA services for personal care provider organizations. We do them on unlicensed supplemental nursing service agencies, educational programs, temp agencies. So we're doing over 1,000 a day now. And so the only ones in the human service, in the health and human services arena that we are not doing are the family child care. And so as you recall, there have been bills seeking to move those background studies from the counties to the state. As happened for adult foster care background studies in 2009, and child foster care background studies in 2007. So there's been a gradual move of those background study duties from the counties to the state. And so the last holdout is family child care, as you mentioned. So this doesn't charge any fee for those. The counties have their own fee system in place for those background studies.
So, Mr. Chair, so it leaves that intact. It's really the centers that are already charged for background studies. It's increasing their fee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawik, it's more or less before it was understood that the cost of doing background studies was in part recovered in licensing fees, but it wasn't quite. You know, what we're reacting to here, there's a provision in Chapter 16A that says that if a government agency charges a fee for a service, it should be about right. It should neither significantly nor under recover actual costs, unless there's some other statutory provision inconsistent with that. And so we have operated under that unless for many years. So even though sort of the assumption was that the background studies were covered in the licensing fee, it wasn't really. And so what we're trying to do here is to figure out a way to systematically recover all of the actual costs and to do it in a way that makes sense. So if a child care center can keep its turnover down, well, they're going to pay less of a background study fee. They have a slightly lower licensing fee, and if they can control the number of background studies they do, their fees will be reflected in that. In some ways, we might see a decrease in the number of background studies we do. There is no limit on it now, and in fact, it's encouraged. If somebody's going to fill a position and they have 10 applicants, there's nothing in the law that says that you can't do a free background study on all 10 people and see what shakes out. And so if they have to start paying a $20 fee for those, probably most employers will narrow that a bit until, you know, do a background study on the people they're most interested in. And so we anticipate that we might have, you know, a slight decrease in the number of background studies, but at the same time, you know, providers will be able to control some of those costs themselves. If they can keep turnover to a minimum, you know, there's an incentive there.
Representative Slawik, is that good?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's it. I mean, background studies are really important. I mean, obviously we want kids in child care to be safe, and one of the ways to figure that out is if you had someone potentially traveling or working at several different child cares that wasn't safe. So I think it's really important. It makes sense. It's always complicated, Mr. Chair, with DHS. I'm just trying to understand what it means. So once I think I almost understand it. So I appreciate it.
And Mr. Kerber is here to help make that more simple. Yes. Representative Franzen, and then Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber, would this thing maybe possibly for some centers to save on costs, maybe put our children at harm by them not running a background check?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, I think that, you know, one of the things that we've considered over time is if the $20 fee for a background study is going to be a disincentive to do the background study that they ought to do. We hope not. Although, at the same time, we know that there are centers who don't always do the background studies as they're supposed to. Now, it's not probably out of any kind of intent. It's that they forget and they don't have good systems in place when they have new hires and that kind of thing. But we're hoping that the $20 fee isn't that significant. I mean, it's another fee, but $20 per employee, you know.
Oops, I'm Francis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber, have you spoken to the child care centers to get their reaction on the increased fee?
He'll be hearing from them soon, I think. Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and members, actually, yesterday was the first time that this proposal was made public, and today is the first time that we actually have some details to share, and so I'm looking forward to that.
Now you're on TV. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm not necessarily opposed to fees because we should be getting back, but... you know, what service the state is providing in some instances. But just one thing that piqued my interest when you said for agencies to keep turnover low,
yeah.
It's very likely that many of these agencies are going to get rate cuts. And you can look at the discrepancies when it comes to social service agencies and the low pay already amongst their employees. How could they keep turnover low while the rate cut? I think that's difficult.
Mr. Kerber, is that just a...
Mr. Chair, that's a difficult issue.
Okay, Representative Gottwald wants to help you out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I have to our testifier is, and pardon me if this is a dumb question, but I look at this and I say background check, and I'm thinking BCA. I'm not thinking DHS. And I'm wondering why we're not having providers, requiring our daycare providers, for example, to simply seek or be required to seek a background check through the BCA and pay for it directly that way. Now maybe you can enlighten me.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, there are a number of activities that are included in this background study fee. I think if the last time I checked, if somebody were to go to the BCA themselves, if an agency were to go and get a printout, you can look at some information online. It's not as in-depth as what we see in our background study. But there was a $16 charge at one point that I think was what they had standardized. When we do these background checks, that $20 fee is averaged over many. As I mentioned, we do over 1,000 of these a day. And so we're looking at the BCA records. We're also looking at statewide whether or not people have a history of a vulnerable adult maltreatment or child maltreatment as determined by adult protection in the counties or the health department or our agency, as well as adult protection or child protection at the counties. And so then if there's reasonable cause for us to go to the FBI, then we obtain the individual's fingerprints and we go to the FBI, and that costs us another... It's $25 a pop on those, and so all of that gets averaged out in that $20 fee, and so we end up kind of chasing down a lot of information that wouldn't be immediately available to an employer going to the BCA. And then what's also built into this cost is our system of determining whether or not a criminal history or maltreatment history is significant. And the legislature has provided great guidance in that area about what kind of crimes we should look at and how much time can pass before that particular conviction can drop off of somebody's background study relevance. And then there's an appeal process in there. So people can always challenge whether or not we made the right disqualification decision by challenging the correctness of it. And at the same time, they can challenge whether or not, notwithstanding the fact that I may have committed that act 2 or 3 or 10 years ago, today I don't pose a risk of harm to these people I want to serve, and this is why. And so we have a fairly robust system of people getting a more in-depth review to determine whether or not they are appropriate to work in these settings. And some of those people also have a hearing right, a fair hearing, and in some cases a contested case hearing. And so there's a whole lot that gets included in that $20 fee. More than just going to the BCA and saying, does this person have a criminal record or not?
Mike, this is a helpful discussion. I just have one more question that I think will let you go back to work. Do child care centers and so on, do they have to do a background check, right? Is that they're required? And so they'd have to pay the money anyway, and so the fee or not, they'd have to comply.
Mr. Chair, that's right. These background studies have been required of these programs that are part of this proposal since 1991.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, thanks.
Okay.
That's the end of your pages. You escape while you can, I think.
Thank you,
Ms. Sullivan Sutton is going to come. Thank you. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. So we're on page 21. So members, we're on page 21 of the change pages. I think you have several of these, Ms. Sullivan Sutton. So you know what you're asked to talk about, so
Yes.
Please do that.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at DHS. The first item that the committee had questions on is on page 21. This is the governor's recommendation to change the adoption assistance and relative custody assistance appropriation to reflect the current caseload estimates for the next biennium. The request is for approximately $5.7 million in 2012 and just over $7 million in 2013. Of that increase, about $5.2 million reflects restoring the base appropriation for the existing caseload, and the remainder would cover the caseload growth that's anticipated in the biennium. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
And so this is not forecasted item. We appropriate what we think we need. Is this a customary increase that we do?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. This is not a forecasted program, but you see this almost on a biannual basis, sometimes annual basis.
Questions, members? I guess that must have cleared up the question somebody had. So,
okay, the next
move along, yeah.
Is on page 23, and this has to do with the governor's recommendation to fund the growth for the Minnesota Food Assistance Program. As I mentioned yesterday, this food assistance program is available for legal non-citizens who are over the age of 50 years of age. The appropriation requested would allow us to provide assistance to the current caseload. There was an appropriation, a current appropriation is for $407,000. In 2011, you appropriated a one-time appropriation of $150,000, but that reverts back to the $407,000 for 2012, and this funding is needed to maintain our current caseload.
Questions? Okay. Keep going.
The next item is on page 24. These are proposed reductions to what is now the Child and Community Services Act, and this is a recommendation to reduce the Community Services Act by $10 million the first year of the biennium and $12 million each year thereafter. The proposal would also redirect any remaining funds for core safety activities in the areas of adult and child protection by the counties.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, so this is a cut to counties.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, yes, it is.
And if they wish to continue those services, they would have to raise property taxes. Is that correct?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, this is a reduction in social service dollars available to them. Currently, the Child and Community Services Act allows them to provide an array of services, and this would refocus, as I mentioned, existing dollars on the core protection activities. And again, these were very difficult decisions in trying to balance the need to maintain individual benefits to people, but it is a reduction.
Representative Huntley?
That's fine.
Okay. Anybody else want to ask about this? Do you have more pages in your packet? I'd like to go back to just a question. Back to the adoption thing. I haven't spent any time studying this part, but I'm forced to learn all these topics now, even in the greater depth. Would satisfy the demand for the adoptions that would currently be scheduled to be adopted in this interval. And these the adoptees are in some other program that we're funding in the meantime. Is that correct? And so is there a saving somewhere else when we spend these monies, or is this a net of all that?
Mr. Chairman, this funding would allow us to continue adoption assistance for kids who are currently on the program, as well as those children who would come onto the program in the next biennium. But for the adoption assistance program and for these children being adopted, they would remain in foster care at the expense of the counties or, in a couple of instances, the two tribes that provide these services.
Oh, so it's a county expense.
The foster care expense is borne by the county. The counties pay the non-federal share. Once a permanency decision is made and children are transferred legally permanently to relatives or are adopted by adoptive parents, then the state picks up the cost of supporting them.
Thank you. That's helpful. Any other questions? Okay. Keep going to the
next. Okay. The next
change page.
The next item is on page 28, and this is a recommendation to add the state community action grants. This would be a recommendation to eliminate state funding for those grants. It's a total of $3.9 million. Grants currently go to a statewide network of 28 nonprofit providers, as well as 11 tribal governments, and these entities provide a vast array of services to people in the community that are financed by a variety of sources.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Sullivan, how much federal money is available to these? I mean, this is not a match, but how much, if we're going to cut them, how much will they have left if they're getting the money from the feds?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, currently the CAP agencies are funded through a variety of funding sources. The state, the funds that you see, the $3.9 million, are also coupled with other federal funding of $284 million. And through all of the programs that they administer, it's about $460 million worth of services that are provided through those agencies. But as I mentioned yesterday, the President's budget does also recommend a 50% reduction in the direct state the direct federal appropriation for community action agencies.
And Ms. Sullivan Sutton, how much is the federal appropriation currently? Do you know offhand?
460.
The current federal appropriation is just over $7.5 million.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sullivan Sutton, I think the concern that I have with this cut, and I was talking to Representative Lanning, is that, Mr. Chair, it looks as though the federal budget is offering a cut, and I don't know if we just talked about that because I was a little distracted, but they are proposing at the federal level a cut of community action by 50%. Now, they know they have a long ways to go through their process like us, but it sounds like if we end the great work that community action agencies do and are widely regarded as being some of the most successful anti-poverty programs in the state, and they're also getting a huge reduction at the federal level, I think that there's going to be a great impact on poverty in the state. And so I didn't know, as you were just trying to figure out, and I know we have a lot of tough decisions, if you had factored in what the president is proposing as a cut to this program.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we did not see the president's recommendations until the day before the governor's recommendations were released, so we did not have that information available to us.
Representative Hayden.
Well, I just think that it's something that, as we deliberate the best practice and the best process, as we figure out how to make these really tough cuts, that looking at programs that work within the communities in which they serve, not only do they do anti-poverty programs and work with communities and families, but they also do a tremendous amount in terms of keeping the heat and lights on throughout our state, especially as we head towards the spring. And so, and there's a ripple effect of these families are displaced because they can't have their heat on or they're not getting the services. They end up kind of flowing back in our social service system and go to some of the ones that I frankly think people think aren't as effective. They end up in those systems and they start to grow. So I will watch very closely and to figure out if we can get some money back into those CAP agencies. I think they do a fantastic job.
And Representative Hayden, my particular local, they make a dollar go as far as a dollar can go. They even like stretch the ink off it, I think. This is why I've been working so hard to find other ways. And the department had to make some choices, and I just feel for the process they had to go through. And so this is why I keep calling for people to think of innovative ideas. But if this is the sort of thing that will happen if we don't find some cool ways to do things and push everybody. I've been sat with Representative Schumacher in my office as I pushed another hospital hard to help me out here to kind of think. And there's a couple questions, but the most common discussion in my office, I've never had so many meetings in my office as I've ever had in the last 2 months, I'll tell you. right, Representative Huntley? Suddenly they don't want to come talk to you. Is they want the world not to change. They want their situation to be as similar as it was, and nothing's the same as it was. You know, we've never been so challenged in so many ways, with actually so many opportunities to do something a little bit differently, and as we focus on the outcomes that we're after. So I'm sincere in that, you know I am, and so I think this is a good attention-getting device, and I don't think they're kidding about as they looked at their array of choices. So anyway, Representative Franzen.
I'm good.
Oh, she passed. Lanning. Oh, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like to echo the concern that Representative Hayden has expressed to members of the DHS staff. If you were to take a look at the Commission on Poverty recommendations, bipartisan recommendations, you would discover that eliminating community action grants and the FAME program, things like that, are working at cross purposes with what that bipartisan commission recommended, and I was on that commission. And so I would hope that the department would take a much closer look at this, and we need to make sure that we're doing things that will help people work their way out of poverty. And by eliminating these kinds of programs, we're going in the opposite direction.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Representative, I appreciate your comments very much. As I mentioned yesterday, these recommendations were very difficult for the department. And as we looked at what the choices were available in particular areas, one of the other alternatives was to look at reducing eligibility for poor people as well as the benefit level to them. And the recommendation here has nothing to do with how these programs are valued in terms of the outcomes that they achieve. It was simply tough choices among tough choices. I appreciate your comments.
Let's move on. Thank you.
The final page that I have that you indicated questions on is on page 34, and this was the proposal to increase the child support cost recovery fee. As I mentioned earlier, yesterday, currently we have a 1% recovery fee for non-public assistance cases. Currently, 66% of that recovery goes back to the federal government. The remainder is distributed to the counties, with some maintained at the state level. What this essentially does is, by increasing the recovery fee to 2%, it allows us to refinance, put some refinancing in our prison system. So essentially what you have is a general funds prison reduction that is reflective of the reduction here. We would use the 2% increase to, rather than going straight to the general fund, we would provide that increase to PRISM to cover the cost to administer the fee, and with the remainder going to counties, there would not be a change in the level of the fee going to counties from one year to the next. That would remain constant. But to achieve the general fund savings, we would be able to move the cost of the increased fee to PRISM and then send the PRISM general fund savings back to the general fund.
And Ms. Sullivan Sutton, is the reason, so this is, what percentage of the child collections are included in this fee? I mean, you told us before, but I forgot. It's a, is it a third or half or something?
It's a very small amount. I'm going to ask Wayland.
And are we, and there's a reason we only do it in the non-assistance cases?
Yeah, actually on the page, the 2010 fees were just over $1 million, and that's the fourth paragraph. And I'll ask Waylon to help here. Waylon Campbell, who's
welcome
the director
the
of child support.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Waylon Campbell. I'm the director of the child support division. The fee is charged only on non-public assistance cases. And that includes people that were on public assistance at one time but are no longer and who have been off for at least 2 years. And the fee is charged on every case. It's actually, the fee is charged to the person applying for services. In most instances, that is the custodial parent. In some instances, it is the non-custodial parent. If it's the custodial parent, the money is withheld from the collection as it comes in. If it is on the non-custodial parent, it is added to the amount that is charged.
And the reason we don't do it for assistance cases is just not to add to the burden of those individuals, or was there some other reason that we don't do that?
Mr. Chair, we didn't think it made any sense to charge people who are already needing money from the government to get by.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm just trying to learn about this. So. Not endorsing, like Representative Liebling's statement, not asking that we would do this, just understanding why we might be doing something. So, any other questions about this? Representative Hayden.
But Mr. Chair, Mr. Whalen, could you explain to us a little bit about, or Ms. Sullivan Sutton, about the increased, that this flow from that to PRISM and what is PRISM, and then it's backfilled to the general fund? I don't know if I totally followed it, and I imagine some members didn't either.
Sure.
The
increase in moving this from a 1% fee to a 2% fee would allow us to take that differential and direct it to the PRISM system, which is our child support information system. We would then take general fund saving, general fund money that would have otherwise paid for child support activities. We would take that and send that back to the general fund.
Representative Hayden, is that good? I think we've exhausted this topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thanks for coming,
Mr. Chairman, members.
Is that the end? Thanks for coming today. And Ms. Bartolik, I think you're next. Welcome to the committee, and who's ever going to go, just jump in.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. I'm Jean Wood with the Aging and Adult Services Division with the Department of Human Services, and we have been given a list of the pages about which you had questions, and the first one on our list is the one entitled Separate Elderly Waiver and Nursing Facility Rates.
And what page is that?
It starts on page 50.
Thank you. So go ahead and just
briefly, this proposes to separate the automatic annual adjustment to elderly waiver monthly case mix caps from the potential increase in nursing facility rates. And this is being done because there are future costs in the rebasing of nursing facility rates, plan closure rate increases, and nursing facility surcharge increases that will come into play in future years that will raise the nursing facility rates, but it's unrelated to the costs of providing elderly waiver or alternative care services. And so the governor is proposing to separate these so that elderly waiver case mix caps are only increased with specific authority from the legislature.
Questions? No? Okay, please keep going. I think that was helpful.
Okay. The next page that you had on your list was managing elderly waiver and alternative care programs.
What page?
And that's on page 41. And this is a variety of actions that reduce expenditures for elderly waiver and alternative care in about six different methods. One is that it brings people who have two ADLs into the new lower case mix L, thus identifying them as low need and giving them a lower benefit. It also proposes to reduce the community budget for low-need elderly waiver individuals. And again, low-need elderly waiver individuals would now be required to have two ADLs. It also reduces spending in customized
Ms.
living.
Ms. Wood, it's going to back up. What's a community budget? Is that their total cost of care for the month that they get to spend, or what? Can you explain that for us?
That a community budget. There are case mixes. They run A through L, and as they go up, they have higher and higher budget caps that have been set, and that is the maximum that can be spent on an individual in most cases.
Okay, thank you. Keep going, unless somebody. Oh, Representative Murphy.
Yeah,
didn't see it there.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wood, I'm just wondering if you at the department have sort of sorted through what the impact on the cap of elderly waiver and cuts means in terms of numbers of people that might end up in a nursing home.
Ms. Wood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, we have, and we have on the page down toward the bottom of page 41, have noted that 415 people are expected to enter nursing facilities from housing with services settings as a result of these reductions.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would anticipate, Ms. Wood, that would then be an increase in spending someplace else in the budget.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the part of managing the growth or moving somebody, you know, down to a lower classification, can you tell us what that person, general characteristics of that person would be and what services they might lose by moving down to a lower benefit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, activities of daily living include things like eating, walking, etc. And so an individual who is at the case mix level L has relatively low activities of daily living requirements. What we exempt in the activities of daily living requirements in this one and two category are those that are unschedulable, which exclude. So we exclude toileting, transferring, or positioning. And so people who have heavy needs are automatically excluded from case mix level L. As far as other characteristics of these individuals, you know, the average age of a person on elderly waiver is 82.
Representative Hoffman.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like some more specifics. I mean, what type of services a person who has now under this proposal would they lose by moving to the new classification?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haas, it's hard to specify what services that they would lose without knowing what their their needs were. I mean, it's really dependent on the individual. But for example, you know, they may no longer, they may have been given, you know, three baths a week, and now they would only be given two, let's say. You know, I can provide some further lists for you.
And just a last question, just I think it's important to know what we've done up to this point. What has happened to the elderly waiver program with past legislative actions?
Ms. Wood.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, from past legislative actions, we have you have increasingly put low need people into this case mix L in order to target resources to those in the highest need. But also the individuals, the participation in this program has increased over the last few years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So have we not cut elderly waiver in the past?
Ms. Wood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, elderly waiver has not been cut. It is forecasted and has increased over the years.
Representative McElpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask if we are lowering the expenditures in one area to see them rise in another. Could you explain the rationale for that, please?
Ms. Wood.
I'm sorry. Someone was talking to
me. Okay. Why don't you repeat the question?
Please repeat the question.
If we're, and I can't see you.
Just talk loud.
If we're lowering our expenditures in one area only to see them rise in another area, can you explain the rationale on that, please?
Ms. Whitten.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a delicate balancing that you have to do. As we cost these out, we always look for the sweet point, the point where we are, in fact, saving money overall, even though, you know, some people may be going into a nursing facility or may have to go into another setting. So, again, these are aimed toward budget reductions, and we calculate them very carefully.
Mr. Meckel, is that good? Okay. Why don't you? Oh, you want? You can continue, I guess. Representative Hosh, do you?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify. I believe, I mean, I was involved in some of these decisions. I think we all voted on that elderly waiver did receive cuts in their rates, and I just want to make that clear.
Oh, in the rates.
Yeah,
Ms. Wood, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, you are correct. Last year there was a 5% cut to rates in customized living and 24-hour customized living. Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I think you. Well, we have 5 minutes, so keep on going to the next thing. Are you out of things? Oh, Representative Kiffmeyer, don't go on to the next thing.
Well, actually, I do have the next thing, or a next thing.
The lister, yeah.
Okay, that you might go to. And I know since we're short of time, I just wanted to be sure and get this particular one. But this is on page 51 and 53. Is that out of your presentation for today, or if you're not going to be back?
Well, we're going to.
It is on the list? Okay, well, then I'll wait.
So why don't you finish
then
up,
I'll wait.
Why don't you finish up the list of six things you were going through, or what, four things on this page 41. Did you finish that?
I believe I have.
Okay. Are there any more questions on page 41 and 42? Proceed.
Okay. starting on page 51 is reduced provider rates and grants that does a 4.5 rate reduction for all home and community-based services. That would be for both for aging and for the disabled. And then a 4.5 base level reduction to aging and other continuing care grants for those that run on a grants program. And then there's also a recommendation for a 2% reduction in nursing facility rates. When it comes to the 4.5% rate reduction for home and community-based services, customized living or assisted living is exempt.
Questions? Representative Fritz. Oh, did actually Representative Kittmeyer first.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's interrelated with both page 51 and 53, so it's related directly to this. But it's because the two pages are separated that I was just working on understanding, because you have a non-rate payment on page 53, and then you have a 2% cut on page 51. Okay. Are those two added together, or how do they interrelate with each other? It appears to be in the same area, but just...
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm Bob Held from Division Director for the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division, and page 53 is in my area, and the 2% nursing facility rate cut is on page, I think it was 51, is also in my area. Mm-hmm. And those are reductions that do have an interaction with each other, but that are essentially independent of each other. The across-the-board rate reduction of 2% for nursing facilities would say that whatever the operating payment rate is for a facility for a given RUGS class is going to be reduced by 2%. Okay, that rate is also used for determining the enhanced rate or the bed hold rate or the single bed payment rate. So those are independently being reduced in this proposal. For example, on the bed hold, which we currently pay 60% of the established rate, we would now pay 30% under this proposal. And it would be 30% of a rate that's 2% smaller than it would be otherwise if both... Mm-hmm. Proposals are adopted.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it appears as though it is a doubling up effect. So you would have a 2%, and then plus the second one goes from 60 to 30? But even that is reduced by 2%.
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's correct.
Oh, it is. Okay, very good.
Senator Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Mr. Held, then, under this budget proposal of the 2% cut in rates to nursing homes, I know you've been at this a long time. What is your take on how many nursing homes will close?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, I think you actually have to look at the whole package of proposals together to try to draw a conclusion on that. And I have to confess, I'm not really sure how to answer the question because, I mean, we don't know. We don't. First of all, the range of effects of the whole package is quite different. Some facilities will lose less than 1% of their total revenues because of this. I think it would have no effect in those cases.
Members, let me just interrupt you. It's our time. We're going to continue a few more minutes. I'm going to turn the gavel to Representative Kiffmeyer in a second. Next week, curiously enough, on Tuesday, we're having long-term care nursing home kind of day. And we're going to discuss some of these very matters. And maybe if Mr. Held would bring a bunch of materials so we can kind of see it in front of us, that would be a good transition for these questions. And then we can, after I leave, you can cover a few more questions. We're also going to take up four bills. On Wednesday, we're going to hear a legendary Gottwald House File 8, and then take public testimony on the governor's budget. That'll be pretty much our one day for that, unless there's just a huge, huge demand. And then we're going to finish up these areas, which I think we can finish on Thursday with another 15 areas or so. So that's just what's coming up. And Rep. Senator Fritz, you had to continue
on. Thank you,
please.
Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to just make one more comment then, and then that is that we have certainly seen our nursing homes, some nursing homes close in that since I've been up here. And also there are so many that are just on thin ice now, and especially out in greater Minnesota. So I just wanted to have that on record that with this deep cut in rates, I honestly would like to know if the department has any idea how many of those homes would be closing in the very near future.
Madam Chair, Representative Fritz, I'm not sure if you want me to attempt to answer that now or wait until next week. I'm glad to say I have a little more I can say right now.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that, and I think Representative Fritz, I think our questions are too much for the time that is left here in this room. We have another meeting. We have some other things going on. And Representative Huntley.
I would just like
comment
to Madam Chair and Mr. Held or whichever, if you could prepare us like a one sheet thing with some bullet points that gives the total effect on nursing facilities from all these different pages. That would make my life a lot simpler.
I think, Representative Huntley, you've made a good point, and I think that's been kind of the direction of our questions, that they're pieced around, so it's a little bit hard to kind of, if you could just please pull them together a little bit more as Representative Huntley's requested, I think that would be very helpful. Okay, members? Right, and the other question from staff here, you can leave your books here. They need them here. That's a different. I know you'd love to take them home and read them through tonight. However, you can't. The staff has to have them here so that they can do some important things to prepare them for us. So, members, with great reluctance, we will leave our binders here and look forward to a future day. With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.